When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Good morning. Welcome to Sawcast number 35. This production of Sawcast is brought to you courtesy of Jocko Willing Productions and his talented staff, along with Saw Chronicles. My name is John Stryker-Meyer. I'll be your host today. And I'm joined by Chad, our technician. Thank you, Chad. And today, for a special guest, we have Bill Werther. Bill and I served together at Fubai and later at CCN, and we want to get into a story or two with Bill. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Well, glad to be here.
Indeed. And we're going to go to On the Ground, and there's a little bit more of a background. This would be one of a story that has like a story within a story.
Right.
But it involves one of the more unique, well, two unique characters, aside from yourself on your team, at CCN during 69. And I'd like to start off with a little bit. This is early March, and two of the people we're talking about here is Ricardo Gonzalez Davis. And when I got to CCN, I thought he was like a PFC. He was young, energetic.
All baby-faced.
Yeah, all baby-faced. And we had a formation somewhere, and he came out in the formation. He was an E7. I'm going, right. WTF?
This, right.
And he had been in the Army so much longer than I realized, but he had great experience, and he was on Copperhead with you, Jim Lamont. And then the first scene that I want to talk about a little bit here is you and Jim and Ricardo had run three or four missions that were dry holes, which is, in and of itself, unprecedented.
Yes. You get in? That doesn't go very often.
No. And the classic example is the one we were talking about earlier today, where your team was in, you're on the ground for 5 days, you observe the enemy, duty reports, and then at the end, it's like your end of your 5 days, you went home with a successful mission without a firefight.
Right.
So you had several like that. And then there was a, we're back at the club now, and I want to give a little flavor of Jim Lamont here. And so going to the book, On the Ground, says, one afternoon, a RENF, that's a rear echelon mother, came into the recon bar while Lamont, Werther, and Davis were discussing their string of dry holes. The RENF came up to Davis and said, you're the one who ain't been nowhere, and you ain't done nothing. It was loud enough that everybody in the bar heard it, and the bar came to a pause. Davis stood silent. Not Lamont, a Detroit-born street fighter and an expert in the Okinawan martial arts style called Ishimru. Did I say that right?
I think so.
Close enough for government work?
Yes, I know it.
Lamont stepped in front of Davis, and he told the RENF, you've got it all wrong. It's me who ain't been nowhere and ain't done nothing. You owe him an apology. When it was clear an apology wouldn't be forthcoming, Lamont pushed the big mouth outside and once again quietly requested he apologize. Instead of repenting, the RENF threw what turned out to be his first and last punch. The wiry Lamont broke the fellow's jaw and knocked out a few teeth with a roundhouse kick that sent the desk jockey sprawling. When the RENF stood up and again moved towards Lamont, he received a broken arm and a few cracked ribs for his stupidity. Staggering to his feet, the bleeding RENF made a last slow-motion lunge at Lamont, who, good-naturedly fellow that he was, decided to take pity on the poor bastard. Instead of annihilating him on the spot, Lamont pulled his T-shirt up over his head and left him to stumble around like a blind drunk. The ref was ejected from CCN the following day.
Right.
So along the way, you get promoted off of Copperhead, and then you had to leave the team. And so there was a mission where Ricardo still the 1-0 and Jim go onto a target.
Right.
And so the target was launched out of NKP, and they get into Laos, and the team got inserted on March the 16th. After the good insertion, they were on the ground, and Jim was the radio operator. And so he had some combo troubles. They were on the ground. They had a good, quiet night in their RON. In the morning, they established communications. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The communications drought continued. And I'm getting back to the book now. And sensing that the NBA was about to close in on it, Lamont recalled years later that Ricardo Davis came up to me trying to bring a little levity to our situation. Now, again, the team's on full alert. They can sense the enemy. And so Ricardo comes up to Jim, and this is Jim saying, he says, "I'm going to take a shot at you pretty soon, just so you know what it feels like." So Lamont smiled, but had the distinct feeling he would not need Ricardo's help getting shot at, because Lamont could see on the team's tail gunner signaling urgently that NBA soldiers were close, very close. Before Lamont could finish processing On's warning signal, his hand gripping his throat, an AK-47 erupted. Three sides opened fire on RT Copperhead. Four rounds slammed into Lamont's rucksack, driving him face first into the ground, destroying his main radio, the PRC-25. Lamont said later, "As I was falling to the ground, I heard Davis call out, 'Jim!' I yelled back, 'Wait one, Dave!' I bounced up, firing on full automatic. I fired at least three magazines before I slammed the magazine in at a bad angle, causing the car 15 to jam. Then suddenly there was a complete unearthly silence. And to that soundless instant, Lamont somehow knew Davis was dead."
And that's just, right.
That's just that scene where they're on the ground, and that's just one of those moments in time that somehow that team survived. Jim was able to get the team out, and they came back with all the indige. Everybody was wounded, but they were not able to bring out Ricardo or On, because both were killed in action.
Right.
And the enemy activity was so severe at that point that they were lucky to get out, period. And with the team was they were all Hmongs.
Yes.
And so explain a little bit to our listening audience why the Hmongs were highly valued as indigenous troops by our people.
The Hmong pretty much went with special forces, and they were so loyal that they were primarily living in Cholon down in Saigon.
Right.
And so that's where the special forces got their troops and developed different missions and so on. So they were so loyal that we never worried about them, you know, not
right.
helping us or doing anything.
No friendly fire or enemy activity like they've had in Afghanistan and things like that.
Yeah, no.
So when they came back, you were there to greet the team when they came back?
Yes, I was.
Because you're in the process of training up a new team.
Right.
So they come back, and of course, Jim was devastated.
Yeah.
And just a little bit of that team spirit, what did you guys do after he came back? It wasn't like immediate tournament. You had to take care of the family for the indigenous troop, as well as help Jim? What was a little bit of that instant healing process that you all went through?
Part of that was when he came back to FOB4, just everybody was just so silent.
Oh yeah.
And myself, I ran up and grabbed him and hugged him and walked off with him. And then the following day, Jim had to go down to Saigon and get debriefed.
Right.
And while that was happening, I came up with the idea, like riding a horse. You fall off, you get back on it. And that's what, anyway, I told Jim, that's what we should do. And I said, I've already got a mission cleared that we can go back in with Copperhead.
And you would take over as the 1-0.
Yeah, because I had been changed from Copperhead to Moccasin prior to them going on this mission.
Yeah.
So when
you get promoted because you've done a good job.
Yeah. But I got a hold of Jim and talked to him about going in on one more mission. And I don't know if you could say I talked him into it or whatever.
Well, you encouraged him because that's like you're the senior man because he knew he was newer on the team in terms of service, time in country, things like that.
Right.
And you were the wise old man at that point.
Well, I guess I was. but we picked up a good mission. We went into training for about 2-3 days,
and then intensive training.
Yeah,
because we were up at Quang Tri, and I went down. We were getting ready to launch on a target separate, and we heard about it.
Right,
and it was like, oh my God.
Yeah,
yeah, and then also just again going back to the book a little bit because you were really good. Werther could tell Jim's confidence was down. And you understood why Lamotte might doubt himself. Because every recon man suffered through a painful self-examination when he lost a team member. Werther tactfully laid out his proposition for running another mission. You explained it. You all did the training. And within a few days after that extra training, you took a 10-man team and you launched out of Quang Tri.
Right.
You had a target. And was that just like a general recon mission at that point?
No, what they had, our mission was to go in and see if there was a bunker complex in the AO where I was.
Right, okay.
And so that really was our mission, was to go in and either see if the places are occupied or, had they been there and left.
Sure.
So that's pretty much what's why we went in.
Yeah, and and the other thing I like about this chapter, because they get into some of the tactics and things, and so the team gets inserted, it's without incident, you move during the day, and then I like some of your tactics here. As night approached, Cal and Sang, these are your two of your 8 indigenous members on the team, found a good RON, rest overnight site, above a trail that ran near a ridgeline. This is the part I like. This is your tactics. To be extra cautious, Werther passed it by and had the team move into a second diversionary RON. Just that last light, the team abandoned the false site and returned to its preferred RON. The team then spent a restful, uneventful night. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, we used to do that as much as we could, because if you had trackers, they'd be right, behind you.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas when you do the RON in another location, then they don't know where you are.
Exactly.
So that's why the RON was so important.
Yeah, and we used to set up the RON, but I don't remember, maybe once we did it that way, but again, we may have done it as adjusting to the situation as opposed to you had an SOP on it, which is really good. I like it. And so moving ahead, you had a good night. At first light, you were able to establish commo, and you came across a trail that obviously had been well-traveled, heavily traveled trail. And at some point, two NVA soldiers crossed the trail in front of Lack and Sang, and they took him out with single shots. And that was the beginning of a firefight.
Yes.
And again, you're on high ground, having picked, selected, and right. now have a good defensive position up there. And you had a defensive position. Within a few minutes, eight NVA troops were moving up the mountain towards the team. They were unaware of the team's exact location, so they were probing in hope of finding it. And so trying to keep your spot anonymous as far as you could, you used hand grenades and M79 rounds first.
Right, right.
good going. And and so now you're fully engaged in the firefight.
Right.
It's going back and forth. And how that first fight, you began to get your first wave attack at that point?
Yeah, they wanted to come up the hill where we were. They didn't know exactly where we were. And so that's why I went with the grenades
sure.
and the M79. And it was a good while before they really found out where we were.
So then at some point, they attacked your right flank where Jim was.
Yes.
And they had been engaged for a while and back and forth. And you could hear that side of the perimeter. So you being the 1-0, I love this. There's a line here. It's just so cool. It says, you made your way over to the side of the team's perimeter. Quote, I was amazed but pleased to find Lamotte smiling at a pile of deceased NVA who died trying to reach him and his teammate. I'll never forget that moment, Lamotte said, when Bill came over to me and said, Jesus, you've been busy. Real busy. And I didn't say it out loud, but I said to myself, this is Ricardo's revenge.
Yeah. That's all I could think of at that point.
Yeah.
We were on the high ground. We were dispersed right and left, and we were starting to shoot up a lot of people.
Oh, absolutely. And this is before you get TAC Aaron.
Oh, yeah.
You're there by yourself.
Yeah, we're there. But what was so good about it was is that we knew where we were, where we were moving, but the NVA did not.
Wow.
And by us throwing grenades in the M79, that even made it more difficult for the NVA.
Yeah. So at some point, an NVA platoon began advancing up the mountain towards you, your first A1 Sky Raider appeared.
Right.
And you were able to direct the old warplane, instantly delivered 500-pound bombs dead center on the
yes.
NVA, thanks to you directing them in.
Right, right.
That could slow down in advance.
Yeah, yeah, that was slowing us down.
But, yeah, but again, that didn't stop them.
No, they were coming up no matter what it appeared like.
Whoa. And then I'm trying to think. How many airstrikes did you go through that, or do you recall? Because you had A1s. Was there any other support, any other gunships? Or
we used A1s primarily because of the power and the time they could be on target.
Sure.
We got F4s in towards the end of it, but I would have always taken an A1 over an F4.
Oh, yeah.
Just because of accuracy and the size of the munitions.
And they had a wider variety.
Yeah, sure did.
And that could be from miniguns, 20 mic cannons, 250, 500-pound bombs, rockets, and napalm
yeah.
for crispy critter time.
Yeah.
And, you know, later on, when you were talking about it, in a typical understatement, Covey announced to Werther, the AO is too hot. We got to get your asses out of there. Werther agreed, looking at his watch, and discovered that his team had been in heavy contact for more than 20 minutes. Somehow it seemed longer. What a day we're having. We have no wounded, no dead. He crawled over to Lamotte to let him in on the latest developments and found the Detroit Street Fighter back at the top of his old fighting form. Lamotte gave him a giant bear hug and said with a big shit-eating grin, we're kicking your ass.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's not many times that I can recall being on the ground and thinking, felt that good about it, where I yeah. can say, we're kicking their ass. But you guys had the high ground.
We did.
And they made the mistake to keep coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
It was evident also, excuse me.
Sure.
That the NVA did not ever know exactly where we were.
No kidding.
Because, like I said, grenades and M79s, they kept us hidden, if you would, on top of the hill.
Yeah. And then I think, too, even with the A1s coming in, they would knock out each wave, and nobody in the wave that was killed could go back and tell the new wave, hey, those guys are, but they're not.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right.
And then for a minute, we had to talk a little bit about the first hand, one of the hand grenades that Jim Lamont threw.
Yeah. To this day, Jim said, I don't think I threw one in the woods or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Because during this time, again, because the grenades had worked so effectively, you yelled, here comes another wave attack. And the enemy was rushing the team, perhaps in a desperate effort to get close to the belt, because that was a tactic. When they, by now, you have the A1 Sky Raiders making their raids. And when they could hear the plane coming, the NVA, instead of turning and retreating, they would charge the team in an effort to get close to the belt of the team members.
Right.
And you were experiencing that with those A1s. And you said, let's see, throw more grenades. And then Lamont yelled, grenade, meaning he threw it. And then...
and it bounced back. That's why I say to this day, Jim says, I don't think that happened.
Yeah. And he's just lucky that nobody was hurt with his own grenade.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this firefight goes on for quite a while. And at some point, they decided to you're able to get an extraction. So before the extraction comes, you make several gun runs. And because of your location, a helicopter can't land. So you got to be pulled out on strings.
Right.
And so I assume you divided the team up to be two extractions on strings.
Right.
So the first one goes out, but you and Jim are the second one going out.
Yep.
And again, the way you described it, you felt like you were puppets on strings.
Yeah, and these were Maguire rigs. No, these were not Stabos.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
And explain a little bit the difference, because from the early days, we had nothing other than a Swiss seat tied into the D-ring. Then they came with the Maguire, which was like a leather parchment of some kind, thick leather.
Right.
You sat in and had a hand grip at the top that you could hold on to in the event that you passed out or you got wounded. At least your arm would be in, you would stay in it.
Right.
And this is part of the advancement on that technique of rope extractions from a hot LZ.
Right.
So the first helicopter gets out, and then you're in the process of being pulled out. How did that go?
Yeah, Jim wanted to put the last claymores down. That was usually our our technique.
Sure.
Prior or during the extraction, we would leave a claymore behind. And we did in this case, Jim did it, not me. I went out with the first group.
Okay.
Letting Jim wanted to go out.
Sure.
And when we extracted, we were clean, went well. But for Jim's case, it didn't go as well because he put the claymores out. And when he touched them off, the pilots thought that it was...
our B-40s.
Yeah, right.
Whoa.
So because of that, he went out with four.
Wow. So and then when he ignited those claymores, it shocked the hell out of the helicopter crew and caused the pilot to lurch forward, momentarily forgetting the five RT Copperhead men he had in tow. And you were watching in despair.
Yeah.
As they were in the jungle getting bounced off of trees. And you were just happy to see them finally come out of the jungle. But again, going back to the book, you were happy to see them come out, but that was short-lived because you realized that Lamont appeared to be unconscious. Not only that, but he was hanging by his arm from the wrist in that Maguire rig.
Correct.
Nothing else was securing him.
No, not at all.
Oh, my God. And, you know, you realized that any moment he could plunge to his death from that thing.
Sure.
So they go back to, you're able to get back to the Quang Tri launch site, and you were able to get on the ground. And when the second helicopter came in, you rushed over and were able to get to Lamotte. And getting back to the book for a second, you get to Lamotte and Werther, and then Jim had this little dizzy grin on his face. And he goes, "I must have passed out, Bill. My back, my legs, they really hurt. The pilot must have thought the Claymores were incoming." And you reassured him, said, "Everything's okay." And you lifted him to his feet. And he goes, and then Jim talking to you, "Damn, Bill, we offed a lot of people today without a single casualty. Thanks for getting me back on the horse." And you told him, "Davis would have been proud of us today." Amen.
Yeah.
That was quite something.
Yeah, it was. It gives me tears right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because we heard about all that. It was just unreal.
Have you ever wondered what happened to legendary Chuck Norris? He's in his 80s and still is kicking butt and working out and staying active. What's even more shocking is he's stronger, can work out longer, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife even started doing this one thing too, and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, her body looks leaner, and she has energy all day. Chuck's made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone can do the same thing to see incredible changes in their health. Go to mymorningkick.com/SOG and watch Chuck's video right now. Again, that's mymorningkick.com/SOG.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money
at Menards. So just for a little footnote, another little element that we had, a few days later at CCN, the command and control headquarters at Da Nang, a much beloved female singer, Martha Ray, who had been made an honorary Green Beret, returned to the small bar at CCN. And she'd been there previously. Every time she'd been there, I was either at the launch site or in the field. I never got a chance to meet her.
Yeah.
But she loved Ricardo.
Oh, she did. She loved everybody.
Oh, yeah. And so Lamotte had to tell her the bad news. And when he told Martha Ray that, Lamotte went outside and found her crying. So I put my arms around her, and we cried over our eyes out together over Ricardo. And then a few months later, Jim went back and explained to his wife what had happened and to his father,
right,
who was a sheriff down in New Mexico.
Right.
And that, I just can't even imagine doing all that. And there was one other, many years later, you and Jim would get together, and you finally came to terms with the death as well as you could over Ricardo Gonzalez Davis. But together, they knew that they and the indigenous troops of R.T. Copperhead had extracted a devastating revenge on the enemy that took his life, and that helped more than a little in easing their pain. Indeed.
Yeah.
Such a moment in time, Bill.
Yeah.
So this is 1969, and you and I are together there. And again, we just knew of the loss of Ricardo. Where did your time in the military all begin? And how did, when you and I were talking, yes, I forgot that you went to high school in Korea.
Yeah.
So how did this start with your beginning, how you wind up in the Army, in Special Forces? Because you had some amazing time in service before you even got to SOG.
Yeah. One of the interesting things is I got a phone call. This is probably in 65. And it was my grandmother. And I was working, making industrial racks in a company. And so with her calling me, she said, "Bill, you're going into the Army." I said, "What?" And so with that, she explained. She played cards once a week with her girls.
Right.
And so the gal that ran the Social Security office told my grandmother that I had a number and that I would be drafted within two months.
Oh, your draft number was up.
Yeah.
Because the draft was still in place at that time, 1965.
Yep. And so I ended up anyway after that. I went down and started to check on Marines, Navy, Army, and that I was going to join. I wasn't going to go in as a draftee.
No.
That wasn't going to happen. So,
because just for the people to know, the Vietnam War was escalating,
yep.
And we had known that if you're drafted, once you're in the Army or in the Marine Corps, you would get 8 weeks of basic training, at least in the Army for sure. 8 weeks of advanced infantry training, 1 month leave, and you're in country.
Yeah.
Without much explanation about the politics or who knows what kind of training they would get with a conventional unit.
Yeah.
Right. And like in my case, when I read the book, The Green Berets, I said, I want to go with these guys because I knew that I'm a city slicker. I need more than just basic and AIT.
Right.
But you also had experience in the country, so you were a little bit more adept at being out in the wild, whereas me is like,
well... Besides that, me going in the way I did, years later, it was 1960, and my family was living in Korea. My father was an engineer, and his job in Korea was to establish different industry, and so that's how I got there. And I left in 63, went back, went to college for 2 years. And then I decided that probably the best thing for me was to go into the military, in which case I did. And did the typical.
Your grandmom called you.
Yeah, you know, the typical stuff, basic training, AIT, jump school, special forces school.
Well, how'd you get to the special forces option? Had you been aware of it from the book, The Green Berets, or just seen the movie, the song? The song was out by then.
The song was out by then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
put silver wings on my son's chest.
Yeah, and I was thinking originally I'd go be a ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found out that there was something better than that, so then I applied for special forces.
Right.
And so that's how I got in. And first assignment was the first group in Okinawa.
So get the time frame here. So you get in the Army, you go through basic AIT jump school training. What was your... MOS as you went through.
I was
training.
A COMO man.
Oh, all right. 05B4S.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is today the
18
Echo.
Yeah.
18 Echo.
Yeah.
And so you could do, hey, what kind of word speed did you have on there?
Oh, I was not good.
Me either.
I was not good.
We're talking about Morse code here.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. I got passed over on the first
I got recycled.
Evaluation.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then I got through it at the very end.
And you got it. Okay, so then your first assignment with your Beret is the 1st Special Forces Group in Okinawa.
Yes.
And so you get assigned to an A-team there.
Yeah, 313.
Wow.
So 313.
Certainly. Oh, 13. Okay.
Yeah, and that's what the Indige thought. 13 is a no-no with Asians.
So your team was all Okinawan A-team then? You had your SF men and then your indigenous troops?
No, there were no indigenous troops at this time. It was just
a regular A-team.
Under A-teams. And the first real mission we got was to go into the mountains in Korea and the different, I guess you would say, we were guarding the passes because they had infiltrated
North Koreans.
North Koreans, yeah. And so we went on that and was a blocking force between different valleys. And we knew, I'll go back a little bit, we knew something was up because there were cases of 5.56 and grenades and claymores, and we're sitting there going, this isn't, you know.
This is our
fun
ammunition.
And games.
Our ammunition or enemy ammunition?
Our.
Wow.
So they just load us up with all the different things we needed. And so then they put us over into Korea.
Right.
And our team split up into two groups. And we protected the valleys, if you would.
Sure.
And the South Koreans ended up killing two and capturing one. And it was crazy.
And they were infiltrators trying to get into the South.
Infiltrators trying to get in. And it was kind of interesting because the one that was in our area, they came in and they did stupid things like before the war, according to the North Koreans, you would get on a bus and you would pay when you got off, whereas these guys paid when they got on. And so they immediately notified police or Korean Special Forces was with us.
And, yeah, because in Korea, because of the Korean War history of the North attacking the South without any forewarning, there was always that extra edge.
Yeah.
That no matter where you are, and this is now, this is 65, so that's 12 years after the armistice was signed.
Yeah.
And you're still on guard.
Yep.
And the anticipation was the shit can hit the fan here at any minute.
At any time, yeah.
And you didn't know. And whenever anything popped up, other agents, there had been drama along the DMZ area there anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Prior to that.
So that was the first mission.
Yeah.
Then the second one is we went over to Taiwan and did training missions there. Then we came back to Okinawa and we trained for a what's called a snake bite.
Right.
And what it is the first group sent four 12-man teams into Vietnam because they just didn't have the manpower. And when we're at FOB 1 in Fubai, problems were that the fifth group didn't have enough people, and they were running back-to-back missions.
Well, don't forget, too, at Fubai, we had the yellow plaques on the wall.
Right.
For every snake bite team that had been there.
Right.
And there are several plaques.
Yeah.
So we were aware of that first group lineage.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I just want to get back just one little backward, back the tape, but just a little bit. Your team was in Taiwan, which today, in the year 2023, is still in the news.
Yeah.
And there's still some training going on behind the scenes, quietly, with 1st Special Forces Group to help the Taiwan people in the event that the big ugly bear, China, wants to come back to do them dirty. But that's fascinating, part of that SF history.
Sure.
So were you on a snake bite team that went to Nam?
Yeah.
Okay, when was that? I forgot that. That's why. Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, the first snake bite team went down in like June or July.
This is 67? 68?
No, 67.
Okay.
Yeah. And they were the first group that went over. I was in the second group to go over.
The second group of four teams.
Yeah.
And that would be for a six-month tour of duty?
Yes.
Correct. And, and you found yourself at Kaesong?
Yeah. We got sent to Da Nang. And then we got sent to go up to Fubai. And while we were up there, we did a couple recon missions to bail out the guys that were stationed there.
Oh, no kidding.
What we did is went out and put surveillance on this one particular village. And they had been notified that this was an NVA meeting place. And so myself and Mac Jones with Starlight Scopes overlooked this, and it just more and more people gathered. But what we did is then notified Arvin Artillery that this was happening.
Right.
And so we backed off and walked back to Fubai. But while that was
in night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what happened then is we just went back and they went to business with the artillery.
So this is at the end of 67? Before you go to Kaesong?
Yeah, this is before.
Yeah. Because when I got in country in May of 68, we were doing local ambushes at night.
Right.
And the Starlight Scope, just for our listening audience, is the first night vision apparatus.
Right.
Which was heavy, it was long, and it had a green images. So when you look through it, it ruined your night vision. So you had to have one eye for night vision and one eye going through the starlight.
Yeah.
But you could see people.
Oh, yeah, you could.
And you could delineate the action, and then you pull back and then called in artillery.
Yeah.
Hurting the commies one more time.
We had, when we were first at Fubai, we were in charge of the Cambodian battalion. And what we did is, it was a Cambodian hatchet force, basically, with an A-team. And we also went on blocking force missions for the 101st and for the Marines. And
this is by now we're talking about Tet, early 68.
Yes.
Okay, so Tet is launched. There's attacks all across the country, and your Cambodian hatchet force go out and do a blocking force in conjunction with the 101st Airborne and the Marine Corps, different operations.
Right.
So they would drive the enemy towards you all, and when they got there, you had firepower, machine guns, I assume 60 mortar meters.
Sure.
And you devastated them.
It was fun. It was interesting.
It was fun.
Well, we walked into this village, and we had some shooting going on.
Yeah, of course.
So we knew, and we were notified that there were no friendly shooting. And so then they put artillery on this village. But when we walked in, what looked like a normal village was all sandbagged and big Ho Chi Minh
pictures.
Yeah, pictures and flag.
No kidding.
Yeah. And so we rounded up. Excuse me. We rounded up about, I think, six males. And then they went off their way. We went back to Fubai only to find out that we were going to Khe Sanh.
Oh.
And so we thought, damn, you know, this is tough.
You're going from bad to worse.
Yeah, I mean, we came over here to run recon and do this, that, and now we're going to Khe Sanh.
So at Khe Sanh, we had FOB-3.
Yes.
That was SOG at the time. And in 68, we had six FOBs operational.
Yeah.
So one was Fubai, two was Khartoum. FOB-3 was up at Khe Sanh, outside of the perimeter of the Marine Corps that was there during a historic siege that went on for 77 days.
Right.
And your little A-team walked right into the middle of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Welcome to the war, baby.
Yeah. And our mission up in Khe Sanh was, three of us built a mortar pit for a four-deuce mortar.
Right.
Motor.
Yeah, easy for you to say.
Yeah. And so it took us about a month to get it the way we wanted. But it ended up being 5 foot deep of different materials.
Sure.
Sandbags, skid pallets, just, so we felt pretty comfortable.
So you're secure and you could direct enemy, fire against the enemy.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, let's give us a little bit of the feeling what it's like, because there were times when they had over 1,000 rounds a day would be launched by the NVA into Khe Sanh.
That's true.
For the Marines, and they, of course, any other GI, you were just there, and you're part of that. So in between building your mortar pit and surviving, just trying to eat during the course of a day and night, a thousand rounds, you do it ducking and dodging. That would be anything from a 122 rockets to anti-personnel rockets, smaller RPGs that got close to the perimeter.
Right.
And also, didn't you have a concern about the NVA trying to tunnel underneath? You had to go through concerns about that, which could be disconcerting.
Yeah, they checked those out, those on the perimeter.
Right, okay.
And there was also an intel group that was down in the Kama bunker.
ASA?
Yeah.
That's the Army Security Agency, which was linked with the NSA at that time.
Right.
They did outstanding work on Kama.
Oh, yeah. And the good thing was is, We had a Huey helicopter in the center of the compound. And it got shot out of the air and it crashed there.
Yeah, permanently after getting shot out of the sky. Okay.
And so the intel guys came and looked over everything and he says, "We got a problem." Not to me, but to the headquarters there. And they said, what's up? And they said, well, this Huey is nothing more than a stake, a mortar stake, and that we've got to move that thing. So we had this old beat up water truck, and it went out, threw a chain around it, and moved it. I don't know how far, but
again, for our audience, a mortar stake is...
Yeah, so you use that as to see what distances you need to shoot.
Yeah, for a better, more accurate mortar fire.
Right, right. But they went out and moved that truck. And every day they go move that truck because the NVA were using that truck as a means to... know where the truck is and how much mission they need, how many mortar rounds, and
wow.
So that we thought that was very humorous to move the truck on the NVA.
So at some point, was there any other memorable moments there? Because at some point you come down to FUBA, that's where you and I met for the first time.
Right.
You, Bob Strange, Ray Frovart.
Yep.
The Troll came back, and Mike Tucker, they were all up there. And they closed, FOB-3 was closed in June, and the commanding officer, Roy Barr, Lieutenant Colonel Roy Barr, right. left 3, came down, took over at FOB-1.
Right.
And you all came down. And then did your snake bite team go home? Then you came back to 5th Group?
No. We stayed 6 months. We finished up in July, mm-hmm. and then went back to Okinawa.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what brings you, so you returned to Vietnam.
Yeah, after the snake bite mission, I volunteered for a 12-month tour.
You didn't see enough of Quezon.
No. No, and I had two buddies, Mike Riel and Phil Quinn. And the second night I was back in Okinawa, I'm down in the bar district, and they kind of saddled up and said, you know, when we started talking, they said, we're going to re-enlist. And I said, oh, really? And they said, yep. I said, well, I don't know. I'm home 2 days, and you're doing this.
Well, how close were you to your enlistment getting expiring?
Oh, the same.
Your ETS?
We three were almost carbon copy, just mirror for us.
Wow.
Same
Mike,
time as, go ahead.
No, and well, finish your thought. I'm sorry, I interrupted too soon.
No, I was going to say the three of us were all Spec 4s, and I said, well, let's go somewhere interesting. They said, yeah, let's go to Germany. I said, that sounds fun, you know. And so we were going to Germany for 2 days, and then I can't remember what... We never did get that settled, so the only place that we could go was back to Vietnam.
And you had to re-enlist to do that.
Yeah. And Mike Riel and Phil Quinn, both of them were identical to me. And so that's how we got into Vietnam. They were both on snake bites.
Yeah, okay.
The first one.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
And Mike just, he later on had a little niche in history too, because he ran missions with the All-Indige team with Pat Eddington.
Right.
On the RT Habu, was it? What was his team? Cobra. RT Cobra. And it was an all-indige team, and Mike's appearance was such that he fit right in.
Yeah, yeah. As did
Pat Eddington. He was the 1-0.
Yeah.
And that team was of note because they all dressed as NVA,
yeah.
inserted as NVA, and they walked down the trails as
yep.
NVA. They knew the passwords.
Yep.
And they didn't have to get their pants dirty crawling around the jungle like we did.
But that's how I got back to Vietnam.
So when did you re-arrive?
In October of 68.
Right. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Sure.
And coming in country, the three of us, we ended up going to Cameron Bay. Well, it was empty because we flew in on a C-130.
Right.
And we would make a long story short. We went through the different phases at Cameron Bay, and we would just tell them and say, well, we're supposed to be here. Well, we don't have you listed. And it was like lunch hour. And so they said, well, we'll check it out and come back at 1 o'clock. And so I came at 1 o'clock, and we had orders to Da Nang. And then once we left Cameron going to Da Nang, I came up with the brilliant idea that they don't know we're here. They don't know what we're doing. Let's go to Da Nang and have a good time.
A little R&R first. Yeah. Before we go to get into it.
Yeah. So, Huey came in and left, and they weren't going anywhere near there. But finally, one of the Hueys said, yeah, we'll fly you down there. So we went down to Da Nang and had just a wonderful time. Yeah.
And at some point, you finally got to your duty station. At
yeah, and we finally did get to Da Nang, and they were going to give assignments. And so the only place we could go, Billy Alexander was doing assignments.
Oh, sure, at the Pentagon, yeah.
And the only place we could go, all three of us together, was FOB-1. And we were there a short period of time and then went down to
FOB-4.
FOB-4.
Right.
Yeah. So that's how I got there.
Wow.
On that assignment.
Wow. So then you go through the story that we opened our podcast with. And then after that, how long were you on Copperhead after that? And then your story as it goes forward from there.
Okay. I was sent to Copperhead. Davis was the 1-0 and Lamont was the 1-1. And I was put on Copperhead in October. And so we trained and did three different missions. And not a round was fired. And everybody in the compound was, you know, chiding us because, man, you guys you're not really out there doing anything. You're just probably laying down. And so we did three missions, Jim and I,
yeah,
with Ricardo. And then they put me on as the 1-0 with Lamont being second in. And we did three missions once again with Jim and I. And one was a trail watching, another was checking out a convoy, and the third one was doing a wiretap. And so that was those three. Then Davis came back and he told him, Sergeant Major Vickers, that what Bill needs to do is have his own team. He's doing great. So they sent me to Moccasin, and I was there for several months until Jim and Dave went out and got into that horrible fight.
Right.
But
and you ran your mission with Ricardo's Revenge, and then you came back and you stayed on Copperhead then?
Let's see. After their mission, I ran one more with Lamont. And then I did another one with a guy named Skibo or Skiba. And at RON, they came in and shot us up. And so had we
they
not
hit you
been
in the RON?
Yeah. Yeah.
How but bad?
When they attacked, they didn't attack us right in that spot. They fired on us a little away from it, so they never got the actual location. But within the first 5 minutes, Skiba got shot in the shoulder. I had to give him morphine and carried him out on the mission. So after him, then they wanted me to go to another bunker complex look. And so that...
While you're still on the ground for the same mission.
Yeah. Yeah.
No kidding.
I was going to say, on the mission itself, Mike Buchanan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mike went with me on another mission. And so with that, we got in and got pinned down within, I don't know, 10 minutes. And we were a little bit concerned because we lost a Cobra helicopter
and a Huey, gunship?
And a Huey helicopter.
So did you have to go in for the bright light on them?
No. well, not on them, but right. off to the side. But, you know, we just think, oh, God.
Yeah.
Two pilots down, we're not getting out of here. Because pilots always go first.
Always, yeah.
Always. So that was that one. And I think that was the last mission on
and
that
And you
one.
Also had one where you had elephants on the trail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did.
That was you and Jim.
Me and Lamont. Yeah, we had discovered a trail that had what we deemed as elephant crap.
Right, you come across on literally.
Yeah, literally. So we measured it with a car 15, and we did several different things. But one thing I like to do is to take a Coke can,
right,
with popsicle sticks to elevate it, and uh-huh. then we put a pretty good bit, maybe half a can of C4.
Right.
And that was our bomb for the trail.
So if the Indians picked it up, if I mean, not the Indians, but if an enemy troop picked it up.
Well, they probably had to not so much as it exploded, but when they stepped on it is when it activated.
And so did you, so did you get to have get to see any elephants while you're out there?
No, but the following day we're in the RON getting ready to go, and all of a sudden we heard, bam!
No,
yeah, we heard an elephant. I think all we could say is that's got to be an elephant.
Yeah. Hit the toe popper.
Yeah.
Oh no,
the improved toe popper.
And so then you had another mission where you all inserted from Thailand.
Oh yeah.
And then once you're on the ground, well, you got on the ground, but your team was split.
Yeah.
The two choppers. You had enough men on the team. Yeah. You needed two choppers because of the elevation.
Right. And so we came out of NKP.
Right.
And flew in with what, CH-3s?
Yes, sir.
And as we were coming in, I'd never been in one before. And it started a flat ride, and I'm looking out, and all I can see is this plant, this copper.
You're
chopper.
Over the LZ now.
No, we're not even there.
Okay.
Yeah, we're a block away, just flat as can be, going down the road.
Really?
Yeah. And so,
as you're heading towards your LZ.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah, and the. I don't know if it was what the term is for them with being a gunner or whatever it was, but I finally we got in the AO, and the crew chief is saying, jump, jump. And I look down, and it's got to be at least 10 feet in the different grasses.
Yeah, like elephant grass.
Yeah. And so we're still going, and he's yelling at us to.
So by now you're in a hover. He wants you to jump into elephant grass. And the golden rule was, don't jump until you can see terra firma.
Yeah,
because exactly. Otherwise, we've had cases of broken legs, broken yep. ankles, yep. of people jumping too soon.
That's
and
right.
You and your experience, you know, I ain't doing it.
No, I told him that. And we got close in, and the next thing I know, I'm being pushed, and I go out the door.
Oh, no.
And Sonny is behind me. That's my interpreter.
Yes.
And he's with me. And I look around at him. And Sonny's got headsets still on.
His Air Force headset, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I said, well, hell, I got to get out of this plane. Half my team's on the ground.
Yeah.
And so it worked out fine.
Wow, so you're on the ground, but how far apart were you from Jim and his team that got inserted in the elephant grass?
It was probably 100 yards.
Because people don't realize, when you're in elephant grass, it takes a while to travel through that. And
yeah.
you're trying to be quiet, but it's impossible to be quiet in elephant grass. Because elephant grass is anywhere from 8 to 12 feet high.
Yeah, and we figured we were closer to 10 foot at least. But then the other team with Jim had to come on over to me.
And yeah.
So that was interesting.
So how'd that mission go? How many days were you on the ground?
Oh, I think just overnight. That was not a long one.
And then again, you had to go out on strings.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this time, was Jim able to stay stable on the extraction?
Yeah, he did.
As opposed to coming out on one arm?
Yeah.
Oh, because there's a couple other guys who have gone through that, and they've had surgery. Recent surgery.
Sure.
It's follow-up. It's just such a strain.
Right.
On the body. I just can't imagine dangling from one arm for a helicopter flight when you're going 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. Of course, Jim was unconscious, so he didn't feel it right away.
No, he did.
So, you also, you talked a little bit in some of your writings about what it was like to be on the ground. And I liked it because you explained that whenever you moved in the jungle, you were always moving at a snail's pace, looking and listening to the jungle sounds, because from one area to another, the sounds were different. Some areas had birds and animals, and others had none. I kind of figured that if it was seen, it was eaten by the locals or NVA troops who were traveling through to Vietnam, coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The jungle was hot and steamy during the day, but at night it was cool. Cool to cold in the mountains of Laos. Morning fog was very common, and trouble at first light meant little to no air support because of the lack of visibility. And talk a little bit more about that jungle. And, you know, sometimes, even now, we talk to today's recon people after 20 years in Afghanistan, Iraq, during the desert, the mountains. And when they tell them we would move for 10 and pause for 10 to listen, they go, "What? No comprende, señor."
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but why?
Well, I think it was interesting because, like I said in that little piece I did, the NVA lived in that environment. They knew everything. Our indigenous knew the environment. But it was never, like I said, it's always damp. It's always noisy at first with birds, but then it quiets down. And there's no noise whatsoever.
Yeah, and when that happened.
And that's pretty eerie, because when that happens, you tend to think, uh-oh, maybe they got our trail or whatever. But it was a harsh environment.
It was unforgiving.
All-forgiving.
No, unforgiving.
Unforgiving, yes. Sure.
And then you also, in that little piece, you were talking about how you, in one target you were in, you were on the ground for 3 days. You went up to the west to look at the valley because you were told that there was a truck park. And again, more enemy bunkers.
Right.
I mean, you guys are right there next to a major
thoroughfare.
Yes. As well as the they had a title, Bin something, but they had these way stations along the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Yeah.
So it sounds like more than once you got close to them as to actually into that one.
Yeah.
And, here, you're on the ground, and you receive small fire, and then the firefight goes back and forth, and eventually you formed it the next day, the Air Force, because you had so much enemy activity that the Air Force is going to bring in an art light. How much combat did you all have before, and how were you able to get out on that?
They put so much heavy ordnance in on supporting us, and even an arc like you said. But it was usually the A1s and the Cobras that gave us so much support.
Yeah.
That's how we got out.
And again, the key part is you talking to them, directing the air assets.
Yeah.
And that's a critical component of the team on the ground with that support.
Yeah.
Because life gets pretty scary without.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and we were talking earlier, I forgot to, when we were coming back to your history a little bit, was how you and Jim, when you first met, you also had another interesting moment in time.
Yeah.
Which is this unique synergy between you two. But go ahead, take it from there. When you get on Copperhead, you're introduced, and Rick Carl and you guys are talking about it, and then at some point, take it from there.
Yeah, I was on Copperhead, and I was in the hooch, and I had been made the 1-1, and Lamotte was the 1-2. I get that mixed up when I don't
right.
get
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's a radio operator.
Yeah. But we were in the hooch talking, and I'd never seen Jim or heard of him.
Yeah.
But we're talking, and Jim says, well, where are you from? And I said, Michigan. And he said, the Upper Peninsula or the Lower? And I said, the Upper Peninsula. It comes, we were 30 miles away from each other at birth. And so that was our introduction to each other, was we were both in the Upper Peninsula. Now, what are the odds of that?
And you're both born in the same hospital.
Actually, no.
No?
No.
Oh, I thought you were.
That's been put out, but that's...
Oh, it was. That's why.
It's not true.
That's why you're here, Bill Werther. That's right. Getting down to the facts of the matter. And you also have some interesting stories. And this is like the third or fourth animal story, but there was an RT no name, and they were assaulted by dozens of
gibbon apes.
What?
We're sitting in the what is it infiltrated in the Monkey Mountain?
Right, which is a training area.
Which is a training pacified area.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're in the club, and next thing we know, this no name team calls out a prairie fire, and we're going, what?
And, and so you're on a training mountain.
Yeah,
we're a training on mission.
Monkey Mountain, and I don't recall who went down at the time, but they went down to talk to them, and they said, "Now where are you?" And they said, "Well, what's going on?" And they said, "We got enemy all over us," and everybody's going, "Enemy?
Yeah, Kumbiak."
Well, what they had done is, they had pelted gibbon apes with rocks during the day and got one or two and ate them. And so,
no.
Yeah. And that was his prairie fire. He went back to the compound and he was gone the next day.
Oh, no. But also, you also have some historic occasions in Okinawa prior to your coming to Vietnam, when you were doing HALO, and did they have HAHO back then?
No.
Okay, but you were training up, and so your A-team set a historic mark. This is 1965 or 66 in Okinawa.
66, yeah.
So you were training in HALO at that time.
Right.
And talk a little bit about that historic mission, because I don't want to take away your thunder on that, but that's a unique mission from a different side, not combat, but still very unique and part of your rich history.
Right. Well, it wasn't our whole team. It was a portion of our team.
Okay.
But we had gone to Pintuck DZ in Taiwan, and we were going to make a HALO jump. The problem was that it was too wet on the ground, and so it was not...
Too wet to jump?
Yeah.
You too safe. Get your boots muddy.
Well, the thing is that our LZ, Pintuck, was a big sugar cane field.
Okay.
And that it had rained recently, and then there were other problems with the C-130. So the pilot comes back and he says, "You guys want to make a record?" And of course, we didn't know what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, we can go for a height record if you want."
Really?
And he said, "Just what's going to happen is you guys go ahead and jump, and we'll turn on the lights, green light, if it's the maximum I can get." So he said, "Sure, we'll do that." So we go through all the things. We get it on a plane. We're freezing to death. I mean, I don't know what below it was, but we were freezing.
Oh, yeah.
And so we get going, and the pilot says, "Now what you're going to do is walk back to the tail, and we'll put the ramp down, and when we quit, we'll cut the engines." And so we're hanging on the sides of the ramp, and we got up to 37,000 feet.
Wow. At what point do you put on your breathing apparatus?
Oh, we're on that inside the whole time we're flying. Because normally we were going to do a 25,000 jump. just
talk a little bit about what that's like, because okay, so the unit is pressurized, you don't have to worry about air or breathing.
No.
But when that tailgate goes down, you've got to have your breathing apparatus on,
right?
Along
right.
with whatever equipment you're using to trudge to get out the door.
Yeah, but that was interesting. It took 2.5 hours to assemble. We were scattered everywhere. But what was interesting is as I was sitting on the ramp and looking out, you could
at
see
37,000 feet.
You could see the curvature of the
Earth.
The Earth.
No.
And so when we got off, then it just was black, and Jesus, prayed, oh God, let me find the guys.
Yeah. And so when you free fall, you go from 37,000 feet in a free fall posture.
Right.
When do you pull the string on that?
On, excuse me,
yeah.
On the, they had a...
altimeter?
Altimeter for one, but it had an automatic opener.
Oh.
So we could, if you went below, let's just say 3,000, whatever, it would activate the...
It's because there are times when people passed out
yeah.
or they would
yeah.
get, lose their proper position and
right.
they would get beat up in the air while they're doing the free fall. And if they're knocked unconscious,
yeah.
that apparatus would kick in, saving their lives. At least they would land as opposed to being a splatter.
Right, right.
Whoa. But that must have been cool.
Yeah, that really was. I've through my days, I've shown people my logbook, and they go, "You what?"
Yeah,
you know. I think as I'm flying to Las Vegas or whatever, I look out and it's 37. You know?
Yeah, it looks familiar. I've been here before.
I've been here, and hopefully not again.
Not again. Or at least not without a parachute.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh. So speaking of your logbook, how many jumps did you log over your 21 years in the Army?
I think it was probably 50 jumps, combinations,
sure.
civilian, you know, military. And
static line and then free fall, just for good luck at Halo.
Yeah.
And Halo's high altitude, low opening. So you jump at high altitude, you pull your rope, your parachute at low. And that is a major way of infiltration
right.
by Spec Ops, perfected during World War II by the OSS men on their teams. And that tradition is carried on, perfected.
Right.
And later, even in SOG, we had 5 Halo jumps, combat jumps into Laos. And then there were 12 static line jumps. Majority were in Laos, but a couple were in support of conventional units that were under siege at the time.
Okay.
But we'll get into that another day with another person. Your story, sir, getting back to you. So at some point, as you, after SOG, after Special Forces in Okinawa, what was next? How long did you march forward from there?
I the second full tour, I was sent to Kontum, and it was put on a team that was 4 recon teams and a headquarters. And our thought...
What year was that?
Out of Kontum. I'm trying to think of what...
Probably 70, 71, at the end of 70, 71?
No, they closed Kontum in June or July of 69.
They changed FOB2 to CCC.
Yeah.
But it stayed there. They were very operational. Tailwind went off in the 70.
But they closed the compound, and they sent us off to what turned out to be FANC Training Command.
Wow, what was that?
That was a...
the Cambodians?
With Cambodians, they came over to Vietnam, and they were trained in conventional divisional forces.
Right.
And that came after I was put on a team that they were similar in A teams, but not quite the same. But that mission was to train up those Cambodians, make them infantry, make them good, and then send them back to Cambodia.
Wow. So, and that training was conducted in the Kontum Highlands area or
no,
further
it,
south?
No, it was in... Cameron Bay.
Okay.
Just outside of Cameron Bay is where that training was done.
How'd that go?
It went well. I mean, we did well with the cam boats. I know they, and what was funny is some of them that I recognized were some of them up from Fubai.
No.
Yeah. One in particular, he was a Buddhist priest, spoke perfect English. And he was, I don't know what his rank was when he came over to us, but he was an interpreter at Fubai.
No kidding.
Yeah.
What a small world, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Because when the premier of Cambodia left, then you had the major incursions from the north pushing in, and that's why they were training up to have forces for Cambodia to defend against the invasion that was coming.
Yeah.
And that's what Operation Tailwind, because CIA was set up,
right,
and we had Tailwind in September of 70.
Yeah.
That took the pressure off the CIA that was fighting the NVA that were heading south to Cambodia.
Do you remember when the 1st Division got run out of Laos?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, is that the Operation Lamson?
Yeah.
As part of that. No
kidding. We were at FANC Training Command, and the word went out, anybody that wore a beret was to go to this area, and they'd be assigned to different missions within the compound and the organization, which was Vietnamese. And I get up to Fubai, which is where they're going to train everybody.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they got guys.
And by now we're talking Camp Biggle, because FOB-1 had been closed.
Yes.
You're right.
Yeah. And anyway, we're training Vietnamese recon. And I was there about 2 days, and then someone slaps me on the back in 3 days, and it's Scarface Phil Brown.
No.
Yeah. And Phil and I ran the recon training.
And no kidding.
So, yeah. So we were with them maybe a month. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
On that one. But the troops that we got were great. And their leader was a Vietnamese Cambo, or not Cambo,
With the Arvin or with the Marines?
They were Arvin, but the commander of the element to be trained was a mountain yard captain. And you know,
oh, no kidding.
You don't have mountain yard in Vietnamese.
Whoa.
But we did that mission, and then all went back to the training command. And I was there until I left country.
And then also during the time you were there, the difficulties that we've had with the McGuire rig, which was an improvement. Then they eventually established a stable rig, and you talked a little bit about the stable rig. Did you work on that?
Yeah.
Or help them design that, or what no, was your, the, it was your involvement with it?
It was designed down at Recondo School, and I don't remember the guy. He's an E7, E8 down there, instructor, but he developed the
Because the stable rig, and that was basically, you had two straps, and your webbing, your web gear, everything you wore on your body was tied into it. So when you needed a rope extraction, all you had to do was pull the two straps down, loosen them up, fasten them below, and then you had a hook and you were out.
Yeah.
As opposed to sitting there like we did in several firefights, trying to put a Swiss seat on in the middle of a firefight, which is like, ain't fun.
No, the stable rig was an incredible piece.
Yeah.
A lot of people got pulled out of the jungles on stable rigs.
Absolutely. It was a lifesaver.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because in the 68, we lost several guys. They got either shot or turned upside down. Some knuckleheads, like the Frenchman and myself, got turned upside down and barely hung on. And on those on the Swiss seats. Anything else from Vietnam? Let's get on as you move forward with your life from post-Vietnam. What was next, and how did you wrap up your last of your 21 years of service to our country?
Well, I sure would do it again.
And what did you do?
I always felt that it really was something important that we did. And they figure out how many NVA were on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and I don't remember the actual number, but it was...
When we got there in 68, we were told it was 25,000.
Yeah.
And then they had the indigenous people that lived in the area that were forced to work, to like basically slave labor. You had to work with them or they kill you.
Yeah, right.
They're right. Their simple approach, the communists, that's the way they operate.
Yeah.
And when did you get out of your army and what was your last assignment?
My last assignment was the ROTC in Mobile, Alabama.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good assignment.
Yeah.
But that was the last one.
So by then you're at E-78?
E-8, and I received a O-3 commission.
No.
Yeah.
Wait, well, Captain Werther?
Yeah, that's...
I never knew it.
Yeah.
I should have been saluting all these years.
I caught a lot of hell from guys like Bobrovsky and, you know, Pat Conley and...
Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. So after you get out, what year did you leave the Army service?
I actually had to look it up.
It was so long ago.
Yeah.
Well, it's okay that you got out, and then where did you go from there?
After ROTC, I worked for the Boy Scouts for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And then I worked after them. Those 3 years, I went with a company, the Teledyne Brown Engineering, and they made those huge nets that would go over artillery or over tanks. Or, mm-hmm. That's what our company did.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you always had a need for that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. I was trying to find it. I think it's... 80, well, that's not important.
Well, anyways, it sounds like we got to that point of our interview, sir, where is there any final thoughts or things from your time in SOG and Vietnam or the Army that we may have skipped over that that'd be worth mentioning right now?
Well, I can tell you that my wife has gotten me through thick and thin.
Indeed.
And that I'm very fortunate that I have my wife, and here we are today. And
Miss Michelle.
Miss Michelle is the reason we're here.
Indeed. And this is, you've had several battles with cancer along the way.
Yeah, I'm still in it. But
this is your latest battle, but you've been ahead of it all.
Yeah, I started having problems back in 2005. And
you and Jim also had that iron issue that was like the access issue, which was like, how did that happen? You both had it. It's like, it had to be like AO related. That's my thought.
It is.
Yeah,
it
absolutely.
Too many things have happened.
Wow. Well, anyway, sir, anything else? If not, we will get to our closing mode here and get you on the road.
I think I'm ready.
All right. Well, in that case... We want to thank to all the men and women in our armed services who have fought and bled for this country. We also thank the Border Patrol, law enforcement, first responders, EMT, corrections officers, and these days I think the extra emphasis with our Border Patrol, both on the south border and the north border. And again, we thank Jocko Willink for sponsoring our SOGcast interviews in conjunction with SOG Chronicles, paying for the production and the flight costs. And we could go to my website, which is SOG Chronicles, and the book that we quoted from the early part was On the Ground, my second book. And please feel free to go to the website, SOG Chronicles, where our other SOG cast are posted. Again, thanks to the courtesy of Jocko Willink and his staff, Echo Charles. And we also want to remember and salute the men and women who were not able to return from Southeast Asia, and that today, as we sit here in February 2023, there are still 1,581 Americans listed as missing in action in Southeast Asia from the Vietnam War. And of that number, there are 50 Green Berets, from Laos and Cambodia that were in the secret war. That's the cost of the secret war. And in addition to that, there are at least 83 aviators that we've been able to document over the years who went down, listed as missing in action, killed in action, supporting SOG teams on the ground, hatchet force or recon teams, like we heard today with Bill and with RT Copperhead, and the critical role that they played in the recon teams providing and doing, executing successful missions. Again, we thank our heroes and the men and women who served our country in years past, men like Bill Werther. We thank you. We're humbled by your experience. God bless America.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save.